Hello and welcome. Talking about national security is something of a pastime for many in the media, certainly many academics. It's something which finds its way into social media ever so often. We take great pride in our armed forces. We take great pride in the prowess of our soldiers. And there is a sense that we have always been doing it right when it comes to national defense. We can't get it wrong. But in fact, this common belief, and it's in many senses a reinforcing myth, which one actually sees on social media more now than perhaps ever before, is something that needs to be deconstructed. We actually need to look at our national security culture. We need to look at whether we have an effective doctrine which deals with national security issues. And we need to look at it across governments over a period of time to actually see whether we are in a position to actually deal with some of our biggest security challenges. And in this book, Manish Tiwari, 10 Flashpoints, National Security Situations That Impacted India in 20-odd Years, actually identifies some of the biggest threats. He speaks a lot towards the end about perhaps the biggest threat that India currently faces, the threat of China. Are we really in a position to be honest with ourselves in tackling this incredibly big challenge? Manish, it's been a great read. Thank you so much for inviting me to have this chat with you. Now, a couple of days back, you created a headline before the headlines of this evening were actually out. When you actually decided that you would be, I mean, the book is critical of the Congress during 26/11, not the Congress per se, but certainly the security decisions which were taken. In fact, what you have written is far, far more hard-hitting than what came out a couple of days back. You have written on 26/11, and I quote, "The nation and the world saw that India had just absorbed a body blow to its solar plexus without as much as batting an eyelid in retaliation." Why?
Well, first of all, wish to thank you for doing this. May I also take the opportunity of thanking Mr. Shivshankar Menon for releasing the book, my friend and colleague, Mr. Happy Mohan Jacob, for introducing it, my publishers, Rupa Publishers, for actually publishing this book, and for all, and I want to thank all of you ladies and gentlemen, brave ladies and gentlemen, for coming in on a day when the latest variant of COVID-19 is making more news than this book. Be that as it may, Vishnu, let me answer your question off the bat. 26/11 wasn't a flash in the pan. We arrived at 26/11 as a consequence of being at the receiving end of perhaps the most nasty phase of the proxy war which Pakistan initiated after our victory in Kargil. In fact, if you were to go even further back to 1971, after the Bangladesh war, India became the status quo power in South Asia, and Pakistan became the revisionist power. They operationalized the strategy of bleeding India with 1,000 cuts. The first frontier was Punjab in 1980. They upscaled it to Kashmir. And post the Kargil war in 1999, you had the IC-814 hijack, you had the attack on the Jammu and Kashmir Assembly, you had the Pakistan, the attack on Indian Parliament, you had Operation Parakram, which actually did not succeed in its objectives for the reason that it had no clear objectives. And then you had the Mumbai train bombings, you had bombings in various Indian cities, and then you had 26/11. And so in many senses of the word, 26/11 was that noxious crowning moment in Pakistan's proxy war. Given the sheer scale of the assault, and given the sheer barbarity which was unleashed, in my opinion, I thought, and I've always felt this way, and I've articulated this ad nauseum for the first time on the 28th of November 2008 from the Congress podium itself, that we should really try and explore what kinetic options that we have available and try and operationalize them. The fact that it didn't happen, according to me, was because the quintessential dilemma that has been plaguing the Indian state going all the way back to 1980, that is the use of conventional power efficacious against non-state actors? And number two, if it is efficacious, then how do you calibrate it? And so therefore, to my mind, that dilemma continues even today, notwithstanding Uri, notwithstanding the public ownership of the surgical
Manish,
strikes.
We talk about Uri in a bit and Balakot and a lot of that. But as far as 2611 is concerned, you wrote, restraint is not a sign of strength. It's perceived as a symbol of weakness. Were our decision makers at that stage weak? Were they unable to take a decision to strike? Was it even a realistic option?
In fact, if you read the paragraph in entirety, it does not say that the UPA government was soft on security or it was weak on security. The paragraph says that for a state which has no compunctions about slaughtering people in cold blood, restraint is perceived as a weakness and not as a sign of strength. So therefore, this was about the perception that got created in Pakistan when we chose to exercise strategic restraint. It was not about the fact that the UPA government or the options which it explored were actually weak options. And this is not the first time it happens. There's a context why I make this statement, and the context is Operation Parakram.
Yeah.
When India decided to actually replace its strike force commander, General Kapil Vij, during the middle of Operation Parakram, the second strike force commander, it sent a very clear message to Pakistan. You see, that the Indian state was not interested in pushing the envelope. So whenever India has decided to exercise strategic restraint, Pakistan being the hard and almost quasi-military state it is, does not perceive it as a sign of strength.
Right.
It actually perceives it as a sign of weakness. So that's the context of the paragraph with regard to 2611.
But if there was inaction then, for many of the reasons that you've spelt out, there has been action with this government. There have been the surgical strikes. There was Balakot. There was the air battle across the LAC the day after Balakot. But what has happened, and you've written this, and I tend to agree, is the NDA seems to have made the unfortunate assessment. I'm talking about the surgical strikes. The NDA seems to have made the unfortunate assessment that these strikes pay political dividends. Accordingly, the marketing of such government action to domestic public opinion has regrettably attained paramount priority. Do you believe that a lot of what we did was essentially hype? Not just in terms of the military operation itself, but what followed thereafter?
Look, I don't think that the strategic choices which were made by the NDA-BJP government were wrong in any sense of the word. Yes, they decided to adopt a more forward-leaning posture. They took public ownership of the surgical strikes after Uri. In fact, this was not the first time that surgical strikes had taken place. I have documented in my book that it was a continuum since 1999. It was the first time that public ownership of a surgical strike had taken place. And then, of course, I write about the Balakot bombings, which took place after Pulwama. The central question or the central dilemma still remains the same. The fact is that did it bring about a change in the behavior of Pakistan? And in my respectful estimation, it did not. Because if the Uri surgical strikes had brought about a behavior change in the deep state of Pakistan, then Pulwama wouldn't have happened.
Right.
And Jaish took ownership of Pulwama right after the terror attack takes place. So therefore, the question which the NDA-BJP government or the national security establishment of the current dispensation should be asking itself, that the actions that they initiated or they initialed, have they brought about a substantive change in the behavior of Pakistan? And the answer, unfortunately, is no.
Yep.
There is no empirical evidence that there has been a substantive change in the behavior of the deep state of Pakistan.
You know, when you talk about surgical strikes or you talk about strikes like what we did on Balakot, The real worry is, can India ever right-size a conflict? Can you just strike at a particular level and then feel that this is where it's going to end, that any retaliation will be proportionate? It's interesting when you make one point, and I again tend to agree with this, when you write, what Pulwama Balakot demonstrated was that there was no institutional off-ramp that could have been accessed to de-escalate the situation. Had Wing Commander Abhinandan not been released under Indian pressure or otherwise, or if the Balakot strike would have had unintended collateral consequences, an escalation would have been inevitable. Do you believe we came really close to war?
Well, we certainly did. And there were no institutional off-ramps. The fact is that the government made a strategic choice to target terror camps in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, you know, the Jabba Top or Balakot as it is called. There was a retaliation by Pakistan, and subsequently as a consequence of that retaliation, you had the downing of the Indian aircraft, which was piloted by Wing Commander Abhinandan. And so therefore, at this point in time, there was no communication between India and Pakistan. So you were on an escalatory spiral. And an escalatory spiral in a neighborhood which is nuclearized, where one of the adversaries decides that its nuclear doctrine is actually first use. Now, that's a very, very significant and portentous escalatory spiral. And even today, there are no institutional off-ramps. So, in a situation where you have India, China, which have a no-first-use posture, and you have Pakistan, which is a first-use posture, and then you have the kind of cross-border terror, as Mr. Menon was rightly pointing out, maybe for different reasons, that we really live in a very troubled neighborhood.
And then, of course, is the situation which we face now, the entire China scenario. And you've written, it's a shocking manner, I'm taking this in a mid-sentence, shocking manner in which the Chinese intrusions in the summer of 2020 caught the BJP-led government napping. What makes it worse is that this is a repetition of what happened exactly 20 years ago when India had faced a similar situation in the form of the Kargil intrusions. This is a recurring theme, isn't it? We've had these experiences in the past. We form institutions. We keep talking about it. But then we are caught off guard. Or perhaps even if we are not caught off guard, we just don't react proactively.
Well, 1999, when Kargil happened, the Pakistanis actually occupied a very broad front across 160 kilometers, 9 kilometers deep. And there was an intelligence failure in detecting that particular incursion or transgression. In fact, the Kargil Review Committee, which was then headed by Dr. Jaishankar's very distinguished father, one of India's most foremost strategic thinkers, was extremely scathing on that intelligence failure, and I have reproduced that paragraph in the book. It's surprising that 21 years later, in the April of 2020, when the Chinese decide to transgress, and again across a very broad frontage, it's not as if the Chinese transgression was at a particular point, as it had happened in 2013, Debsang, which was cleared within 3 weeks, or it happened with Chumar when President Xi Jinping was visiting India. This was a transgression across a very broad front. How did it go undetected? And why is it that no responsibility or accountability is ever fixed? The tragedy is that we are having this discussion on China at this book launch for the last almost 18 months in Parliament. There has been not one substantive discussion on the situation along the LAC in eastern Ladakh and now in Arunachal Pradesh.
Have you attempted to ask the government questions on China in Parliament?
Well, every question that I have asked of the government on the Chinese transgressions has been refused in the name of national security. So therefore, it is not Dr. Subramaniam Swamy alone that they have been very kind to, but there has been a kind of a blanket attempt that no discussion will be permitted in Parliament Our deputy leader of the House, Mr. Anand Sharma, is here. He would recall that the government had given an assurance that they would brief the opposition leaders. This was in the September of 2020. And they reneged on that commitment. And every time an attempt is made to raise the Chinese transgressions in Parliament, they are met with a wall of silence.
Would you say that the agreement of disengagement, because you've written about this briefly, that we reached as far as the Kailash Heights in the north bank of the Pangong Lake is concerned, have actually achieved very little? That we gave up a tactically important position, but we've still lost territory?
Look, I think the broader question is, Vishnu, that China has settled 17 territorial disputes with its land neighbors. China only has outstanding land boundary disputes with India and by extension Bhutan. And now they are in the process of settling with the Bhutanese also. The Sino-Bhutanese talks are going on. And Chinese have settled these disputes at far less than what their original claims were. So it begs the question that why is the Sino-Indian dispute not being settled, or why China is unwilling to settle the dispute? I think that's the larger national security question that we should be applying ourselves to, coupled with the fact that, as Dr. Happy Mohan Jacob was pointing out, and I have written in this book, that if India needs to surmount its internal developmental challenges, we require 30 years of peace on our periphery. We need to find a modus vivendi with Pakistan. We need to find a modus vivendi with China, as Deng Xiaoping was able to do it with China from 79 almost till 2012. We need to find that modus vivendi. Otherwise, we will not be able to do justice to our own people.
Yeah. You've spoken on the uncanny parallels between 1962 and 2020. And it really doesn't augur well for us now, because the situation with China is far from over. Therefore, what happens next? Will anything further take place? I think that's a very real question. But here's another line from the book. A difference of 58 years divides the 1962 Sino-Indian border war and the current developments playing out between India and China in the high Himalayas. However, the parallels are spooky. Is it your belief that we are far from ending the immediate crisis along the LAC or the McMahon line?
Well, it's my belief that the disengagement is a good step, that this disengagement is a step back. It is in the interest of both India and China. And I think that we should persevere and try and explore modalities and a modus vivendi where we are able to return to a pre-April 2020 position. I am not saying that India does not have the wherewithal to confront China if the push comes to a shove. But the fact remains is that given the state of our developmental processes, at this point in time, we would perhaps, or we should, err on the side of caution and try and find that that way out, which actually helps both countries to de-escalate. I think a peaceful Asia, a peaceful South Asia, is both in the interests of India and China. And so therefore, from that perspective, the disengagement deal, which Defense Minister Rajnath Singh announced in Parliament, was a step in the right direction, and we should persevere with that.
All right, Banish, this has been wonderful speaking to you. Thank you so much indeed.